Now, it's this procedure that's going to involve something that you would call the foundation. That's why you can paraphrase, how do you know, into some form of what's the foundation or what's the basis for what you claim is an achievement. It's because of this kind of diagram that if you find that there's no foolproof procedure, you conclude that there's no achievement that's guaranteed. Therefore, there is no achievement that has the legitimacy that's claimed for it. Now, the contrasting paradigm is not that somehow, after all, you do find a foolproof procedure, but rather that you start with an achievement, and then over here, that you start with something via Maxim 1, you put it through some checking procedure and see if it survives. The differentiation then is not between a legitimate or illegitimate achievement, but achievements which survive how much checking. And since our ways of checking are themselves limited, we sometimes find things that do survive all of the ways we have of checking them. And were this not the case, what we would do would need to start checking on this kind of achievement and start questioning our ways of checking. So with this kind of paradigm, you do not get into the infinite regresses and you do not get into the hopelessness and illegitimacy. You can even use this as a paradigm for doing research by regarding an experiment as a checking procedure. I'm not sure what they would say. My inclination would be to say no.
What's the difference between unhappiness and despair? If you're reading you're living an authentic life, then you're also probably recognizing your rationality in the world.
Well, what you have to do to understand why it makes sense to say no is to separate the notion of happiness from the notion of pleasure. Which it never really had much association with, except at certain historical times and places. Basically, they're very different notions. And one can be happy even though one is going through all kinds of suffering. Because happiness is associated with the idea of things are going the way they ought to. God's in his heaven, all is right with the world. And if the way things ought to go is that you suffer pain, then your suffering the pain doesn't make you unhappy. It just makes you pain. Now, if you include that in the equation, then you can see why one might say, if you're authentic, you're happy. It doesn't mean you're enjoying yourself. In fact, many of the existentialists would say if you're enjoying yourselves, you're kidding yourself. Well, keep in mind, again, that one reason why this viewpoint expanded into psychology is because, unlike Freud's time, when people used to come in with paralyzed arms or anesthesia or compulsive or obsessive thoughts, beginning like around 25 years ago, people started coming in saying, I'm unhappy. And neurosis. They couldn't think of any more illuminating term, and somehow the patient's complaints seemed sort of philosophical. So it was called a philosophic neurosis. So again, unhappiness is one of the prime pathologies of our time. And here's a system that's designed to give you a lot of access to that kind of phenomena. Now, this doesn't guarantee that you can do a lot about it. It doesn't guarantee that their techniques for doing something about it are better than somebody else's. But their conceptualization certainly is a good one for getting to the phenomena. Once you have the notion that a person is unhappy and that he's being inauthentic, you could try any kind of technique, not just the existential types of psychotherapy. You might then do some desensitization or some impulsive therapy or something else. But to get access to the fact that this can be a problem for people, you couldn't do that if you were thinking along primal or operant or other such lines. Any further discussion on the grounds of existence, authenticity, and self-actualization? Okay, now we come to another interesting feature here, namely the notion of existential guilt. Existential guilt has connections to the notion of authenticity, but it also has connection to grounds of existence and the motivational states. Again, the origin problem. Remember, in talking about that, I said it's clear once a person has some ID characteristics, how he gets more. He gets them by engaging in the behaviors that express those ID characteristics in circumstances which then give him other ID characteristics. So this diagram where you go from some ID characteristics to others via history, I said, is non-problematical. That hangs together. The problem arises, how do you get from no ID characteristics to some? And that was our origin problem. Now, one way of formulating it in existential terms is to say, well, with these notions of motivated behavior and pitch, attunement, etc., You've done a fair job of saying why a person does one thing rather than another. But what you haven't shown me is why he does anything at all. So if you take it as a given that he's going to do something, then you can say, well, his basis for choice is his mood, pitch, and attunement, and his then existing self. But who says that he's going to do anything at all? There is a missing part of the system that needs to be plugged in order to have a formal guarantee that people behave at all. And this, again, is one of the places where we would usually look to some kind of a causal explanation, or at least a causal explanation would be part of this. For example, when Freud starts with simple reflex, or when Allport says that in an infant, most of his behavior is reflexive and is physiologically dominated, they're making that kind of move. The reason why the infant does something rather than nothing is he comes equipped with a lot of physiological reflexes. That's why he does something rather than nothing. Now, an existentialist doesn't allow himself to talk that way. So he's got to take account of those facts in some other way. And what he does is to say, well, the reason that a person does anything at all is that he's motivated to do everything he can do. There is a general motivation to actualize all one's potentialities. And since there is that motivation, that explains why a person does something and not merely the particular thing he does. It's the other things in the picture that account for the particular things he does. It's this that accounts for why he does anything. They lose that motivation quickly. After all, they don't die as soon as they're born. They have to suffer through some of those bad experiences before they start dying off.
Doesn't really explain
it, though. Formally, it
does. Doesn't explain why people actualize some potentials and not others.
No, but that's not supposed to. For that, you go back to states, motivational states, and ID characteristics when they come.
But at the beginning, you don't have those.
You have states.
You have states, but you don't have ID characteristics.
States are enough. See, if you're motivated to do something and certain things stand out more clearly, then it's no wonder that you do certain things rather than others. See, basically, all you need is some element of selectivity, formally, and it doesn't matter too much whether it's perceptual or neurological or psychological or whatever.
So then some people's overwhelmingly negative choices then are explained by later on things, by things like attunement stuff. You don't even relate this general total actualizing motivation to that.
No, because see, this motivation is not selective. It motivates you to do everything you could do. And so it won't explain why you do the particular thing. But it does, as I say, formally explain why you do something at all.
But it's more than just why you do something, it's supposedly why you do all these actualizing things. Or why you at least begin to do actualizing.
No. Because the motivation is to actualize all of your potential, and not all of your potential is self-actualized.
That's it. Yeah.
See, in effect, if you had a list of all of the person's potential behaviors at this time, I suppose there were only five of them. Say, well, since a person is motivated to actualize all his potential, he's motivated to do every one of these. And other elements will select one or the other, but what they will be selecting from is something he is already motivated to do. And that's why he winds up doing something. Because all of these possibilities are things he is already motivated to do. So you need this to provide the basic motivation, and then you need the others to select from among the things that you're motivated. Now, in a comparable theoretical difficulty, other theorists simply introduce a postulate that says organisms behave. And that will do the job too.
Who does that
mean? Some of them. Or someone like Kelly, for example. Say, well, organisms behave. The problem is not to explain that they behave, it's to explain which behave. Now, there's a parallel in this kind of problem, again, in classical physics. Before Newton, people took bodies at rest as their baseline, and if something moved, they said that needs explanation. After Newton, they took constant linear motion as the baseline and said if something is at rest, that requires explanation. If something accelerates, it requires explanation. If something changes direction, it requires explanation. But if it just keeps on going, it doesn't require explanation. Well, that's the same kind of thing. You can see the similarity in the notions. If you think of an organism at rest as the baseline, then if it moves, if it acts, that requires explanation. On the other hand, if you think of a behaving organism as your baseline, then it would require an explanation if it stopped behaving. And if it changed its behavior, that would require explanation. But what doesn't require it is that it behaves at all, because you've made that your baseline. So there are similar types of problems and similar types of moves. Now, this one has some unfortunate consequences. And the unfortunate consequence is that you can't possibly actualize all of your potential. This is not merely the common sense notion that, you know, if you develop along certain lines, you facilitate some possibilities and are handicapped in others. That's a compelling practical argument. Formally, though, all you have to say is, look, there are courses of action which are mutually exclusive and self-contradictory, and you could do either one or another, but you can't do both. So you have the potential for either one or the other, but what you don't have the potential for is to do both. And you're motivated to do both because each one lies in your behavior potential. And there's the knockdown, drag-out argument that you couldn't possibly actualize all of your potential. Okay. I can't both walk out the door and stand here at the same time. But both of those are things I have the potential to do. Therefore, both of them are things I'm motivated to do. Therefore, there is no way that I can ever actualize all of my potential. There is no way that I can do all of the things that I'm motivated to do. Not even him. You can't both be a sorcerer and not be a sorcerer. So you can see that there are some tight arguments that say you couldn't possibly actualize all of your potential. Unfortunately, the notion, this general notion of actualizing potential, gets tied up in the self-actualization notion of actualizing potential. And I think partly because of that, the consequence of failing to actualize a given potential is existential guilt. Now, if you take the common notion of guilt as a reaction to the recognition that you didn't do what you should have done, then that can be transferred readily when it comes to existential guilt here. If what you did was not self-actualizing, then in a common sense way, you can say he didn't do what he should have done. He didn't live the way he should have lived, and so he ought to feel guilty, and it makes sense for him to feel guilty. On the other hand, if you use the same notion to where what it, no matter what it is that I didn't do that I could have done, I feel guilty about that. The conclusion you come to is that everybody is constantly guilty, because nobody can even come close to actualizing all of his potential. Now, this is part of the despairing aspect of it. It's like original sin. You never get out from under. It's inherent in the nature of human beings that they are burdened with existential guilt. Yeah. The principle is that if you fail to actualize some potential, you will undergo existential guilt.
What's the connection?
That is it.
Which is the notion that's usually used? It's usually in terms of not, did not do what was self-actualizing.
No matter what it is. I just gave the principle. If you fail to do what you had the potential to do, existential guilt is the result. If you fail to become what you had the potential to become, existential guilt is the result. Now, what I said was, it clearly makes sense when it comes to failing to do what's self-actualizing. Then you can understand why you would be guilty, and what there is to be guilty of, and why you ought to have done it. But I think everybody, including most existentialists, have some qualms about saying, if I could have walked out the door but chose to stay here, I'm guilty for not walking out the door. And that's so, even if staying here was the self-actualizing and the most self-actualizing thing I could have done, I still feel guilty for not doing something else. Well, you can see why I say that's a despairing and irrational sort of position.
Doesn't sound like the word guilty would be appropriate.
Well, that's the word they use, and...
But guilty is like most people use it.
No, they need it. It has, in actual usage, it has a lot of tinge of regret, but then so does guilt. If you feel guilty about something, if you see that you are guilty of something, you usually regret having done it. If you feel guilty over not doing something, you regret not having done it.
This doesn't imply, though, that the people have to experience all this existential guilt, because, like, people can be existentially guilty and not know about it.
No, it implies that they ought to, though.
Yeah, right. It's the same thing.
That's part of the background of, if you're enjoying yourself, you're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
Because you ought to be feeling guilty, because you really are.
So hence the preacher stance of a lot of the existential.
Seems like you'd have to, before you know what your potentials are, you would have to have done them. So if you didn't do one, you'd feel guilty unless you knew you could.
That's part of the despair. That you can't know ahead of time what will be self-actualizing. You have to make that leap into faith.
Why does anybody buy that?
Huh? Because it's true. Yeah, it's true in the sense that it's not false.
That's right.
Any more than instinct is false or operant conditioning is false. See, the proper criticism is not that it isn't true, but that it's unilluminating, that it's absurd, that it's misleading, that it's narrow, or something like that.
That's why did someone buy that?
Because it's true.
It doesn't explain, though, because you say there are any number of things that are true.
I know, but that's one of them.
What's true?
Huh?
What's true?
That you are in that position.
You haven't shown evidence to convince me.
No, there is no evidence.
Yeah, so like I don't think it's true.
I can't give you evidence that that's a blackboard or that the sun is shining. It can merely point you to it and ask you to see.
You can give evidence.
Well, look, start with good old common sense as embodied in wise old sayings. And one of those sayings is, the things you regret most are the things you didn't do. Remember that one? There's a good deal of truth in that. That saying brings up, to a large extent, what's the point of saying that all of the things you didn't do that you could have done, you have good reason to regret, that it makes sense for you to regret, feel guilty for not doing those. Take cognitive dissonance theory. You get the same kind of story. If I'm choosing between a Ford and a Chevy and I buy a Ford, I start regretting. I start having second thoughts about not buying the Chevy because I can still remember all of the good reasons I had for buying a Chevy, even though I decided a Ford was better. So I do things to adapt to that fact. I either distort, I don't read the ads at all, or do certain things to reduce the dissonance. Well, see, dissonance in that sense is very much like the aspect of existential guilt that old saying gets at. Or again, think of here. Or better yet, this one. When you're choosing among a set of behaviors, the only choices that are really choices are among those that you have reasons to do. But if you have reasons to do something, you have a reason to regret not doing.
Okay. But in common everyday language, it doesn't really come down to when you do something and it's not what you wanted, and then all of a sudden you realize that the other thing has more potential. But when you do things like you stood here and lectured to us, and it's profitable for you, and you can, there's no reason for you to think otherwise, that walking out that door would be better, then you don't feel guilty.
Well, would it make sense that I regret that I can't do both?
I don't know.
Why wouldn't it? Wouldn't I be better off if I could do both since I have reasons for doing both? And I only choose between them because I have to.
Right.
But it would be nice if I could have both. So like I say, since you're choosing among things that you have reason to do, you have reason to regret not doing all of the things that you didn't do. Well, you see, with this set of anchoring examples, you can see why there is some sense to it. And that's why I say that people buy it, because it's true.
But it also seems on one of the extreme ends, you're going to have guilt for things you don't do that don't have reason.
Well, that's where they go even a step further. As I say, I'm only offering you examples of why it makes some kind of sense. It isn't sheer nonsense. And that may explain why they don't just introduce a postulate that says people behave. That they want to get at some of this stuff too. And again, put it in the context of therapy. Very often what you're dealing with in therapy is that old regret or guilt about not doing what the person should have done instead of doing the things that got him into the problems that brought him into therapy.
Okay. And sometimes a person could experience like guilt for something they didn't do, but yet know that they would be guilty for having done it.
Yeah.
So they could be kind of hemmed in.
That's known as being in a bind.
Yeah.
Either way you go, you're going to feel bad about it, because either way you go, you've got good reasons not to do it.
Yeah.
That's where it helps to have all four perspectives, where you can then say prudentially, but I had to do it. Otherwise, your self-concept and your integrity are going to be vulnerable. Hedonic, prudential, ethical. You can see why I drew an arrow between these two, self-actualization and authenticity. That to do those things and be those ways that you don't really have it in you to be is to be inauthentic, and it is to be non-self-actualizing. Think of the connection between the notion of inauthentic and the notion of phony. And the notion of merely going through the motions, and the notion of pretending. There's a set of fairly closely related ideas.
Acting as if.
Yeah. And we use them all in many of the same situations. You say, that guy is merely pretending to be an artist. The guy is just going through the motions of drawing a picture. The guy is a phony artist. He's not a real artist.
Those other words imply some intent of the guy to fool you.
A phony artist is not somebody who's trying to fool you. Most often he's somebody who has fooled himself.
If
the intent is great, you say he's an imposter.
That carries most
of you. Yeah, of deliberate deceit. But plenty of people you call phony when you bet your bottom dollar that they think they're being straight. Okay, what's left? The notion of an overall pattern for a person's life. And this one is imprecise in that it has elements of two very distinct sorts, namely a genuine pattern and a set of general characteristics. If you look at the example in the chapter on world design, where they're talking about the world design of this girl who was very constricted. It said that her mode of relating to the world was that of constriction, of being hemmed in, that she saw the world as hemming her in, she acted accordingly. And this was the overall pattern of the way she dealt with the world. Well, you can see that saying those things is not really giving you a pattern. What it is giving you some constraints or general characteristics of the way she behaves. It's like giving you a set of policies that she follows. Namely, she treats the world as pressing her in. But it doesn't give you a pattern type of picture of what she actually does and how she actually lives her life. So this notion of world design then is something that is used to characterize individuals, not by giving you a sharply focused picture of what they do, but to give some general characteristic, some overall characterization of the way they live their lives. Now, as you might expect, if you're an existentialist doing psychodiagnosis, your major findings would be expressed in your characterization of the person's world design. Those would be the most significant aspects that you found. And even if you found it somewhere else, you would translate it into some aspect of their world design. Incidentally, the thing that brought to mind the word phony, I was thinking in advance of your exercise when you do Fritz and Gloria existentially. And you remember when you heard the tape that about a third or a halfway through, he says, you're a phony. He says, you're pretending to be this way, but you're really not. Well, he might just as well have said, you're being inauthentic. And you have this horrible world design in which you're either far away or indissolubly linked. Now, there are no constraints on how you describe world designs. There's not a taxonomy. You can can say anything you want so long as it fits the notion of a set of constraints on a person's overall way of living. Now, the related notion of mode of being is a little more clearly just a set of categories. If you look at the examples, where some of the examples that were given were of isolation or duality or plurality, these are even more clearly not pattern notions, but simply some taxonomy, some set of constraints. Also, they're discrete in that you can mention one or two things of that sort and not mention anything else. Whereas part of the force of saying this is an overall characterization of how the person lives his life is that you don't leave out important things. You do present a coherent whole picture. And that's why if something is important, it's going to show up in the world design description. It's comparable, but it's more differentiated than just a significance description. The relation to world design would appear in a significance description. There's one other place in the psychological literature where you find something comparable. And that's in transactional analysis when people talk about your life script. They talk of you as having been scripted to act in certain ways with people.
Also, Adler's life style, too, is great.
Styles are not like patterns. There is this duality between pattern and style or other characteristics. And lifestyles are simply not life patterns.
I think he uses it that way when he talks about the kind of unarticulated goals that we give when the kid's about 5 years old or something like that.
Yeah, he refers to patterns. But again, you ask yourself, what kind of taxonomy, what kind of notions do Adlerians use to talk about lifestyles? And it comes out more like the life script. Because it's narrower than really a world design. Well, I guess you're right then. If life script is related, then so is lifestyle. Right. Okay. I was going to say life script is narrower in that there you have some of the notion that you're getting everything important into the picture, but not that much. You can describe a life script picking out only certain themes and recognize that you're leaving a lot out, and it's still a life script. It's still that important a theme. But it's very, very closely related. It's basically the same kind of enterprise of giving an overall ID characterization of a life history, not of an object of a certain kind, but of a life history.
There's no idea of motivation.
No, just the overall pattern. The motivation is kind of implied, for example, when you say she sees the world as pressing her, and the implication, and she treats it accordingly. And you ask, what kind of reason would she have? What kind of motivation would she have if the world is pressing her? And you get some clear but general ideas of her motivation. Because you can distinguish that from seeing the world, say, as a friendly place. You know, she simply wouldn't have the same kind of motivation if she saw the world that way. So the motivation is implicit. Okay.
Let's go to the book. Okay.